Today is Wednesday, March 14th, and committee members, if I can, and I hate to rush you too much, and we can have some questions, but in order for us to finish this budget today and start on mental health, which is a great big one, we have five presenters today, and probably what we need to do, John, let's give them about 16 minutes each.
Madam Chair, I think that some of them have more to say than others, I'll put it that way. I think Dr. Bradley, I don't think, has too much more left in her presentation. And I also think that Dr. Skeel's, his presentation is fairly, 2 minutes he says, so
okay.
There is time for the others to do some good presentations.
Okay, good. So thank you very much. So let me ask Dr. Bradley to join us today. And we are on page 105, I think it is?
107.
Okay, and okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, my name is Kathy Bradley, Administrator for the Office of Family Health, and I do just want to briefly highlight a couple of key points in the last section of the maternal child health program aspect of our office, which starts on page 107. Mr. Britton right now is handing out two handouts that I'm trying to provide to sort of give you some additional background that you'd requested as a committee, and then our office is available to you to have a discussion later on about that, but this is an attempt to just provide a little bit of backup. I do have trend information on low birth weight in Oregon that is reflective across maternal race characteristics, and then I also have a handout in relationship to the subject that was raised yesterday in the public testimony about intergovernmental transfers and the impact on the baby's first home visiting program. But again, the intent is for some material for that, and then we can discuss it at a later point in time.
Madam Chair? Representative Kotek.
Thank you, and I'd also like to pass out, in response to Senator Gorley's comments the other day, this is a couple pages from the Children First for Oregon's data book on health disparities for kids. It's particularly around the birth outcomes, and I thought people might want to see that. So
thank you very much. Thank you for sharing.
The maternal child health program, again, is one of those areas that comprises of a number of individual programs that provide policy analysts, program evaluation, and technical support to our county partners, who are really the ones that are primarily engaged in the delivery of service. The programs under this umbrella are women's health, perinatal health, child health, early newborn hearing and screening detection. We have a child care consultation program that works with the child care community, and it's also the home for our FamilyNet data system, which is our child data system for Oregon. The programs addressed in the booklet in our book and in this overview are the home visiting programs of maternity case management, Babies First, which is our high-risk infant tracking program, and oral health. The maternity case management program focuses on improving pregnancy outcomes by promoting good prenatal care. And so it's public health nurses that are visiting high-risk mothers, high-risk women, in terms of promoting good pregnancy outcomes. We saw approximately 5,600 clients last year for a total of over 46,000 visits. The Babies First High-Risk Infant Service is a program that's funded through targeted case management, and that one is the one that we were addressing briefly yesterday in terms of it's a Medicaid match of a 60-40 match. The predominant referrals are geared towards a child that is, or an infant that's perceived as being potentially at risk for either social or physical concerns. The primary referrals come from hospitals and physicians. And last year, county nurses saw over 9,000 infants with over 30,000 home visits, and the average were 4 to 6 home visits.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm really concerned about the Medicaid match issue. And I'm just thank you for the additional information for Babies First, very effective program. Just want to clarify, CMS came out with rules earlier this year. Have they been finalized? Is there still a comment period? that we can weigh in on?
Chair Carter and Representative Cote. Yes, the comment period is still ongoing. I believe, I know that DHS has actually formally submitted their letters of concern in regards to this, and we can double check to find out when the deadline is. I don't know it. The intent for implementation, I believe, is in September of this year. But we'll get information to the committee in terms of the comment period.
Thank you.
The other area I just briefly wanted to touch on was oral health, which was certainly raised earlier. It is a major concern of ours in terms of the importance of it to the citizens of Oregon. Oregon has actually benefited over the last 5 years with a CDC grant, which is designed to build a healthier infrastructure to improve Oregon's oral health settings. We do this year now have a new oral health plan, which is the result of a very large collaboration of many community partners, which is the first time Oregon has had that, and it will begin to power much of the policy work that we're going to do. The primary focus that we've been engaged in has been on children in the school settings, and the two areas that we have really worked on have been in the areas of school fluoride treatments and then dental sealant programs. In the last year, we targeted over 98 elementary schools and served nearly 20,000 children with fluoride supplement programs, and we worked with communities with over 90 elementary schools to deliver sealants to over 6,700 children. And you'll notice that there is a pop on that that is asking for an additional $300,000 to continue to expand the dental sealant program. In light of the current debate in Oregon around fluoride, this is actually one of the most effective ways that we can combat this. And the targeting, again, is for schools that have 50% or greater children in their school or reduced lunch program, which is a recognition of economic disparity. The only other comment that I would make in summary would be that for us, in terms of key budget drivers, the most significant thing we're concerned about at the federal level are impacts on our Title V dollars, which is the primary funding for maternal child health. We had a reduction of 4% last year. We are slated again for another reduction of probably 4 to 6%, and each time that translates out to $300,000 to $400,000. The other thing is the newborn hearing and screening program, which is highly effective. All newborn infants are tested for hearing potential disabilities, and referral linkages, we have, I think, a 97% screening rate, is scheduled for elimination, and that costs Oregon around $300,000. So very rapidly, in about a year, we could face up to almost a $1 million shortfall in this program, which brings about $6.5 million into the state. So we've got our federal partners working heavily on that, but that's another area of concern. Thank you.
Dr. Bradley, if I look at what the representative just gave us in terms of children first and their data, and then I would look at your performance measures around prenatal care for women in the first trimester, I would be totally, totally fooled by what I see here. But maybe you explain it to me and then I can better understand. Have you seen this piece in Children First?
I have. I don't believe I have it in front of me, Chair Carter.
In offering up that piece, compare it with page 110 of your presentation today and help me to better understand it.
And Chair Carter, which of the figures were you looking at?
I'm looking at the care, the prenatal care around a woman of color, and looking at your other rates. And is that 29.2? The first one in Figure 2, no prenatal care in first trimester for African Americans, 29.2, for American Indians, 28.7, for Hispanics, 29.8.
Chair Carter and committee, first trimester. I think it's a question about what is the level of granulation that's being presented to the committee. So on page 110 in our performance measure, what we're looking at is an aggregate, but what we're really trying to look at there are the number of mothers that in all births and compared to Medicaid births, that there might have been a decrease in prenatal care. And so it doesn't have the separation that we do have in the children's first data, which I think is very helpful. They have the same data sources. The other thing that I think is important to recognize on page 110 is the point that is being made here is that the burgundy bar is actually what are active Medicaid births, and you'll notice it's lower than the blue bar, which is all births. And there's a slight dip in 204 and a slight increase in the red bar, burgundy bar. What that really reflects is the change with OHP and the fact that we had fewer clients on OHP. Now, while it's true that all women that are pregnant are eligible automatically, the interpretation we have for that is that there has been decreased utilization because of a lot of confusion in the community about eligibility. And so that impact has been seen in an aggregate, and it's also very much reflective and consistent with the information from Children's First.
Well, what is your outreach program like in terms of these communities where the incidences are so high in terms of the lack of care?
The other program that we have in regards to this that I haven't mentioned is called Oregon's Mother's Care, and it's an active partnership with Medicaid where we identify women and fast-track them onto OHP. And we had a 78% increase in this last year alone of clients that we moved forward. And so that's been a very active partnership across our communities. And we've also expanded it. We've almost doubled the number of sites, and so it's at the community level where we have specially trained community public health nurses as well as Medicaid colleagues or DMAP colleagues that at the county level can really move and expedite an application for OHP so that we can move the mother quickly onto that. And then the other work that occurs in relationship to that, the mother is then hooked up with a primary care provider, and follow-up is done in terms of linkages with WIC and other community resources. So we've got an active program, and it's seen a very significant increase.
Thank you.
I want to go back to the low birth rate handout that I was given, and looking at the trend lines, particularly for African Americans, where from 2000 it was 11.1, and it dropped in 2001, and it dropped a little in 2002, went back up in 2003, 2004, and 2005. And I noted that the comment was that for reasons that we do not understand, African American women are more likely to have low birth rate, and yet when I look at the handout that was given by Representative Kotek, no prenatal care in the first trimester by mother's race, by ethnicity, if I look at those statistics, that pretty much jumps out at you of, you know, what are the indicators of talking about why there could be low birth rate, particularly when you have African Americans at 29.2%, American Indians at 28.7%, Hispanic at 29%, and I guess it goes to back to the question that was raised: what specific kinds of outreach are you doing with respect to this population?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, I appreciate that, and I think nationally, the research that's been done to try and understand the issues that are related to low birth weight have not provided some of the results that we had hoped in terms of clarity. There is no question that prenatal care is a very critical factor of that, and prenatal care in the first trimester is where the real issue that all of our efforts have been focused in within public health as well as in the medical community at large. But the comment that you saw there really is reflecting more of an epidemiological perspective of the research, that continues to be a great concern and tracking. That doesn't change the factor that the major effort that we have is around prenatal care, access to prenatal care, identifying women that are at risk, and getting them linked in appropriately with a primary care provider. And again, that's mostly through our Oregon Mother's Care. Our Multnomah County partners also do have specific programs that are designed, have a specific program for the African American community that targets those as well, and I don't remember that more, but can provide that information.
Can you follow up, Madam Chair? Can you provide me with a couple of things? One, specifically, what kinds of programs exist within the counties with these particular target groups, African-American, American Indian, Hispanic, and those that where we see high numbers of low birth rates. If you can do that for me, I'd appreciate it. The other thing I would appreciate is that how do we compare? When I look at these statistics, how do we compare with our neighboring states, and how do we compare nationally?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, I'll provide that information for you in a follow-up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, looking at this as a physician who's watched these issues for 20 years, these numbers are very disturbing. Extremely disturbing. Mm-hmm. Low birth weight babies are not only a tragedy for the family and for the child, but also a horrendous cost to the healthcare system. And the fact that with our technology we have available to us now, that we are losing this battle is amazing to me. I would be most interested, not just in the numbers, but what's behind those numbers. One of the things you mentioned here was an increase in cesarean births. Mm-hmm. Is that being driven by medical necessity, or is it being driven by medical malpractice issues? I believe it's probably the latter, unfortunately. Is it being driven by the heavy use of epidurals? Mm-hmm. That might be a factor also. Mm-hmm. The fact that we don't do VBACs in most parts of the state anymore. There's lots of questions here that I don't see answered, and those are very concerning to me. The other issue is, especially minority populations, what's happened to those populations as far as health care access. I know we're losing obstetricians, we're losing nurse midwives. I believe we probably have fewer people doing obstetrical care now in the state than we did 5 years ago. I do not know that for a fact, but I'd like to know that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going on in those populations as far as methamphetamine and other drug problems. I mean, there's a multitude of things that have been causing this, but we're losing a battle here. These trends continue, we'll be back where we were 20 years ago. And I would guess that our infant mortality rates and low birth weights are not the best in the world. Right. I have to know, I think they're probably about 20th or 25th. Mm-hmm. And just giving numbers out doesn't solve the problem. It lets us know there's a problem, and I appreciate that. But it's what's behind those statistics to me that are important. And I would like to see a more knowledgeable report and more in-depth report if you can give it to us. And bring it back to us at a later time.
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, I appreciate your concern, and we are very much in agreement with that. We actually started on a project last summer after our review of our perinatal data to put together a perinatal data book that really sort of reviews all the issues across the board, and are slated to have that done by June of this year, because the concern that we had is that we had multiple points of information, but we really had to pull together materials that could be used to really sort of drive and define policy. The trends that you see here in Oregon, while they tend to be better than the rest of the country, and I can have specifics for you on that later, still are very representative of concerns that are there nationally, that our numbers are, our low birth weight trends are increasing. And so we'll provide more information back. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the reasons for distributing the Children First information is I'm a big fan of what we do in public health, but I think one of the issues is we haven't provided the resources, particularly around prenatal care. I think one of the biggest issues in terms of making sure women, particularly women of color, have access to the prenatal care is we need presumptive eligibility. And so we're not having this issue when a woman is pregnant and then there's some concern about eligibility and then we pay for the birth, but we don't provide the prenatal care. So, you know, I think there's some specific health care solutions to this, but overall, yeah, I think the programs that we have in public health work, we really are not funding them properly. We can't reach all these populations because they get very low general fund, and they're relying on federal dollars that are going to be cut. So I appreciate all the work you do, and this is fuel to get out there and keep working on it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The low birth weight trends in Oregon information is very disturbing, particularly looking at the trends for women of color. And I particularly find it shocking that the Office of Family Health can't tell us definitively what's behind the African-American women low birth weight, or for Native American women. I don't understand, and I need your help to help me understand why we don't know what's behind the race, or why you don't know. I'm just really struggling with trying to understand that, particularly when one piece of information that we do have, is that there's the lack of prenatal care in the first trimester for many of these women of color, which is an access issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really struggling to understand why we don't have a more definitive answer.
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, what you're expressing are some of the very same frustrations that the maternal child health community is struggling with nationally right now. For the amount of funding that this country has and the understanding that aspects such as early prenatal care are really critical, but the reality that we continue to have extremely low birth weight babies is a great concern. There's been a tremendous amount of research that continues to look at this issue, and what I'm trying to share with you, and I will do it in a more explicit way and with more detailed information to this committee, is that the maternal child health community, the medical community, public health community combined are really struggling with trying to understand what are the key issues that need to be addressed. We've continue to address this in the same way with continuing to see numbers increase. We push very hard on prenatal care. It needs to be better than it is. But it's more than just that. There are also concerns, as is explicitly stated here, about multiple births and other activities that we think are more lifestyle and culturally related, which are also influencing this. So I appreciate your frustration. It's one that we very much share, that we don't have really clear direction for us to do very clear programmatic activities.
Let me just add to the difficulty I'm having, which is that there are no, well, there appear to be no specific performance measures targeted to this issue, this subject, this significant challenge. And so my question is, why are there no performance measures targeted at this trend, which is significant?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, the performance measures that we have used to date have been around prenatal care and how Oregon compares around prenatal care, that you'll find on page 110 and 111. But we would be glad to consider having something that would be more detailed, that would be reflective. I can tell you that on an annual basis for our Title V grant, we have a federal review of over 18 indicators, and in there is, I think, probably the level of specificity that you're looking at, and these are discussions that we've had with our region as well as part of our ongoing federal discussions about how we can really make a change in terms of the prenatal care and the low birth weight issues. I just want to share with you, this is a national concern. We have a very distinct Oregon component of it that we need to address.
Madam Chair, if I may interrupt at this point, because others have questions. I think what we're going to need to look at as a committee, we're going to need to focus in a laser-like way on some performance measures that are directly tied to the elimination of racial and ethnic health disparities, and this is one. This is one. It makes no sense to me that we would not have a performance measure tied to this piece.
Let's go with Senator Morissette, Representative Boone, and then Dr. Bates.
Thank you. I think the performance measures have to be doable. I'm not sure that the state has the resources to conduct a kind of a longitudinal study on the various groups that are questioned here to find out if it's a lifestyle, if it's a diet, if it's smoking, if it's drug use, if it's drinking, and what it is. Prenatal care doesn't guarantee that people are not going to do these things. I think there has to be an objective study that finds out what is causing it, and then we can better address it. But a lot of the prenatal care may not even deal with that. They say, well, don't smoke, don't drink, don't do this, that, and the other thing. But I think there's a deep seated problem, and it needs to be looked at the broader. Okay, my question, do you have any, the CDC, are there any national groups that address this issue and have actually done some studies to find out what causes the problems? I think that's the first thing you have to look at, is to kind of tap into the existing information that might be out there. You know, there's, okay, well, then I think that it's dangerous to do a performance measure that you cannot accomplish. So I think a performance measure is great, but let's be realistic about the expectations of what you're going to achieve by it without the resources to do it. This is a serious problem that takes a lot of serious consideration and study and so on.
I think Representative Bowman is next, and then have debates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just to Rep. Senator Morissette, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make the horse drink it. And I think that might be part of the issue. But I actually wanted to go a different direction. And you mentioned it was a little while back about sealants. And I just have a question. Mm-hmm. Because we have a bill in the system now that requires, I think it's cities larger than 10,000 population have fluoride in their water. And even though none of my towns in my area have quite that many people, doesn't mean that I don't care about the issue. But my question is if that were to pass, it would only touch those larger populations. So is there an effort to go back and take care of the smaller populations with sealants if they're not already getting them? And then part B of that question are, if you have sealants, you don't need fluoride, and I'm not sure on that. So.
Dr. Bowman, before you answer that, and I hope Representative Bowman, you don't mind, but Dr. Bates and Senator Winters have questions
on the other. Yes.
Do you mind? And fine. Then Dr. can come back.
Yes, now you have to remember that.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Let me make sure it's my turn here.
Yes.
First off, as we're in the process to a certain degree here of shooting the messenger, you're the messenger. I hope you won't take this too personally, okay? What you're dealing with here, to a great degree, you have no control over it all. You are not responsible for how physicians and hospitals and midwives function. You are recording and bringing to us those statistics, and I appreciate that. So I want you to understand. I understand that part of it. One thing I would ask you to do, and this is for everyone presenting to a committee, and I've asked this in other committees also, if you see a real problem that you're really concerned about, feel free to tell us that. Don't wait for us to ferret it out. When you say something like this, you should be saying to us, I would hope, senators and representatives, we have a major problem that we are really concerned about. I want to direct your attention to these and understand that we are as concerned as you are. Okay. And we often don't get that from people presenting because they're just trying to get all the information out really fast, and we appreciate that too. But if you can focus us on things you must be really concerned about, it really helps us too. And so I'd appreciate if you could try that in the future, and others would feel the same way. You know, this is really a total health problem, not just a problem for prenatal care and low birth weights. I can think of a dozen reasons this is happening, and I don't know which one are correct. In the Order of Health plan, we have 26, 27, or 28 different categories people have to follow to get the plan. It's an impossible situation. We need to get rid of the categories. Everyone at a certain percentage level, 250, 300, is just in. And it's for a year, and it's simple and straightforward. We know we've not funded tobacco smoking cessation programs. We're seeing an increase in young women smoking. We know one of the leading causes of prenatal births is smoking. That might be a factor. And I can go on down the line of all things could be doing this. What we need from you, if you can get it for us, is that information. What is the problems so that we can then work in the other areas to try to fix those problems? Because we're debating right now healthcare in this province. We're debating how much money we're going to put into Tura. This kind of information is vital for us to have to make, hopefully, rational decisions about those areas. So please feel free to say, listen, you guys, we got a problem right here. We may not be smart to see it. I want to show it to you. And these are things that might be driving it. All right? Thank you.
Thank you. And just to thank you, Madam Chair, just to add to what the good senator has said,
it would also be helpful, because I think if members knew what it cost in terms of having low birth rates, that members on this panel would be absolutely blown away as the amount of dollars that taxpayers are paying, pretty much because you have a low birth baby that requires a lot more care than if you have a normal average birth baby, and other things that go along with it. So those who think it's not a issue, it is an extreme policy issue for those of us on this panel, because it is costing all of us a lot. And if you could bring back just even some figures of talking about what it costs, I've been in some committee hearings where we talk about disparity, healthcare disparities, and that's one of the major issues, that when we talk in terms of minority health versus what's the rest of the population and the extraordinary cost that's involved because we haven't made some good policy decisions. So it would help us tremendously when you bring that kind of information to us, including the economic impact.
Daphne, got a lot of questions before you. You can get back to them. But I will put this on the record. It costs us between $30,000 and $40,000 per day for neonatal care. So please know we're talking about a lot of money. And, Doctor, please recognize today from this chair, I hope you don't feel like you've been put on the hot seat. It's just that these are always flags for us. And I like what Dr. Bates said. I like for you putting the problem in our pockets and saying, this is a problem, and you need to help us fix this, because you're the state. And so I hope the hard questions today didn't make you feel too uncomfortable, but know that we feel equally as uncomfortable as well. So any further questions for Dr. Bradley as you finished your report? Is that right?
Chair Carter and committee, I'd like to respond directly.
That's right.
To your question, but also I appreciate the concern and interest, and we look forward to partnering with the committee on moving forward on low birth rate issues. And Representative Boone, just in a quick response, the work that the Oral Health Program has done with dental sealants and with school fluoridation programs has really been targeted for those communities that are more at risk. Mm-hmm. And dental sealants is an evidence-based best practice for all children, regardless of fluoridation. It wasn't around when we were young, but it is nowadays. And it makes a huge difference in terms of sealing the molars and not having caries later on. So regardless of the outcomes of fluoridation, that will remain as a standing best practice in the dental community. We just want to make sure that it's available to all children and not just those that have health care insurance.
Just to clarify, so we still need fluoride to them. Is that okay?
I see Dr. Chair Carter and Representative. Absolutely. Okay. It's considered to be a best practice also as well, and would be very helpful. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bradley. I have a visitor with me today. Her name is Liza. She's a student at Chemeketa Community College, and for the health department to know that she's looking at dietary, at being involved in dietetic kind of environment. I think I'm right on that. But anyway, I'd like to encourage our young people to come to meetings and to also meet people so that they will know who's the future of themselves. So all you guys take a look at Liza, wave your hand, and know who's your future. And I ask her to come with her father, her uncle today to be a part of us.
May I make an introduction as well?
You may.
Madam Chair, I would like to introduce three Portland State University interns working in my office, Megan Clay, Alexis Romanos, and Sabina Shaughnessy. They're doing a fabulous job.
That's great. It's nice to have our young people be mentored and be able to come and select their next seats. We need that. Thank you very much. Dr. Mason, will you join us? Office of Multicultural Health. And Dr. Allen, when you come up, and I know this has been a very robust conversation today, but my concern, and I will be working with you during the interim on this, and that is performance measures, colleagues, are goals and measurements. It doesn't mean that the job has to be impossible. What it means to the greatest degree possible for agencies when they come before us to point out the problems, what they can't work on, and their different agencies, and what they're having resource problems with,
in their agencies. Because I'm getting ready, because I know Senator Gordon has already got a question that she started asking of Dr. Mason yesterday. So, brother, you're in the hot seat today. So you may as well know that right now. So all of you guys know, don't come bringing your feelings and holding them in your heart and in your hands. It's just that we ask tough questions. This is a fantastic committee who wants to support you. So please know that the tough questions are from senior members up here, and that's just the way it is. Dr. Mason, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is James Mason. I'm the Office Administrator for the Office of Multicultural Health, which is a part of DHS as a public health division. The Office of Multicultural Health promotes the delivery of cultural and linguistic competent health services for all Oregonians. Our particular focus is on eliminating racial and ethnic health disparities. A big part of our work, however, also spills over into what are called non-ethnic cultural groups, which are women, people with disabilities, seniors, rural populations, sexual minorities, and so forth. And also, almost by default, we have to deal with issues of immigrants and refugees, and we make the distinction between the two. As you can see, my section begins on page 149. The majority of my funding is not general fund. I'm not going to spend much time with that, and I'm not going to read to you. I'll let you read that on your own. The services we provide tend to be more in the area of technical assistance, consultation, training, research design, resource development, outreach, and health promotion. We don't provide direct service, but we work with a lot of direct service agencies. So we would work, for example, with CAF, mental health. We'd work, for example, with local health divisions, other providers, both public and private. We work with higher education. Area health education centers are AHECs, faith-based and community-based organizations, media outlets, and funders. So a big part of our work is supporting folks that do provide direct service to a range of populations in the state of Oregon. I'd be remiss if I didn't say we serve the entire state of Oregon, which is an extreme challenge for a number of reasons. One of them is that our geographic diversity, when you kind of combine it with cultural diversity, can make for some very, very interesting combinations. So often when we think of diversity in the state, we think of it in the I-5 corridor, but we do things in other parts of the state where you may not have the critical mass or the numbers that that often suggest spending a great deal of resource or time with those populations. But again, we serve the entire state. There are compelling reasons for multicultural health. Among the more obvious, I think, are the changing demographics, certainly in Oregon. Those of us who've been here over the last 20, 30 years have seen significant population shifts. The other thing that's been interesting is that we're finding diverse populations in parts of the state where we didn't see them before. I think they may have existed, we may not have counted them, but we may not have seen them before. This isn't a problem only in Oregon, it's a national issue right now. Health disparities, racial and ethnic health disparities, is another reason that compels an Office of Multicultural Health to exist. Issues around funding, licensure, accreditation, or other reasons. DHS values also compel our existence. And also the business imperative, simply providing good customer service, as was alluded to earlier, holds the cost down with respect to healthcare. A large percentage of our funds are from federal funds, federal sources. And as a result, we have to look at some of the federal health disparities, which for racial and ethnic populations include cancer, cardiovascular disease, infant mortality, diabetes, HIV/AIDS, and child and adult immunizations. What has really helped us over the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years is the fact that in 2001, there was a governor's racial and ethnic task force that identified some health disparities particular to Oregon. And they were namely access to health care as one, alcohol and substance abuse, asthma, diabetes again, HIV/AIDS, and lead. So a big part of my office's juggling act is meeting the demands of our federal funders, but at the same time trying to put an Oregon twist on what we do. How are our efforts significant to Oregonians? The task force recommendations, to some extent, give us a lot of guidance. One of the recommendations was that we enhance our ability to collect racial and ethnic data. Again, this isn't an Oregon issue, it's a national issue, and we've been fairly successful with that, and I'll talk about that in a few moments. Another recommendation that came from the task force was to establish deliverables for eliminating racial and ethnic health disparities. This includes some of the performance measures I alluded to earlier, but it also talks to things around workforce development, where we also play a role. It talks about research and things of that nature. The third recommendation that we use as guidance for my office is helping public health and DHS attract and maintain a culturally competent and culturally diverse workforce. And we do that by partnering with our Human Resources Office, our DHS Training Office, our Diversity Development Coordinating Council, and participating in the Oregon Promise Program. And the fact is, several of my employees in my office are former Promise interns, which helps add to the diversity of the workforce. And the last recommendation that stands out for us is meeting the needs of underserved communities. And again, the task force was focusing on racial and ethnic minorities, but they also alluded to the importance of keeping all Oregonians safe, including immigrants and refugees, non-ethnic cultural groups, as I mentioned earlier, and what are otherwise considered underserved populations that may be that based on rural status, economic status, gender, age, disability, and other issues. Dr. Allen has supported our efforts and has given us additional challenges beyond the ones that I mentioned earlier, but there are such things as dental students, school-based health clinics, WIC farmers markets, family planning, tobacco, and other things of that nature. So we feel we have our work cut out for us. The good thing is that we have partners internal to public health and DHS, and we have partners on the outside. I mentioned we serve the entire state, and I wanted to talk about some of the things that we've done in conjunction with our partners that I think are pretty progressive and cutting edge. With help from Dr. Coneshaw, we were able to do some work or do some research in the area of collecting racial and ethnic data for our behavior risk factor surveillance survey system. We were looking at alternative ways of capturing data from racial and ethnic minorities as opposed to random dial line, landline phone calls. We were invited to present at a national conference to share our findings, and we think they will have an implication for how we collect data in future years. We also work with Dr. Coneshaw around language and talking about health disparities, how it becomes more strengths-based as opposed to damning or to some degree blaming the victim. And we think that's as a result of getting people to pay more attention to what we produce and what we write. And it also gives us a greater degree of credibility, so we think that they will listen to us better in the future. We've also worked with Gail Shibley's environmental health program around issues of food safety and what that means from a multicultural perspective. And we've provided training to a range of her staff to be better at working with the diverse populations throughout the state of Oregon. We work with Dr. Bradley's Office of Family Health, and one of the things that was alluded to earlier that we're very, very proud of is the OPIC document around immunization. We think that's landmark, and we think that will have an impact over the next few years. Also work with the director's office, Dr. Allen, and we produced a racial and ethnic database on community outreach that she and her communications people are using to make sure that we're getting messages out to diverse communities around the state. We've also worked with her office around signage for our building and a Spanish medical glossary. And we participate on public health emergency preparedness activities for the state. And I'll wrap up very briefly, but our major activities have included, and we heard about this yesterday, is our healthcare interpreter certification program. We will be one of the first in the nation to have both an oral and written exam, and we hope to roll that out later this year. We were able to spend a great deal of time talking to stakeholders in the state about what this would mean for us and why it was in the benefit of all Oregonians, not just the 12% that may speak a diverse language in the state. And we were able to visit such communities as Umatilla, Mount Hill County, Jackson County, Deschutes County, and Marion, as well as Multnomah, and talking about the importance of healthcare interpretation, in particular certifying and qualifying healthcare interpreters, and not so much only for the consumer or customer or our patient, but also how that enhances our healthcare system generally. We participate in a lot of outreach and community education activities. Our diversity calendar is circulated widely across the state, and we circulate that to give health professionals and related professionals ideas of where they can go to learn more about the diverse communities and develop their networks. We think that is a very low cost but a powerful intervention. We also provide discipline-specific cultural competency training, which we think is pretty accurate and has been extremely well received. I think over the last 2 years we've trained over 2,000 health professionals in the state of Oregon. Most of our evaluations are, this sounds tremendously immodest, but pretty tremendous. We have very good staff, and we do a pretty good job with that. We've done it for a while, so we get good at things like that. And we are also, as I mentioned earlier, getting better and better at racial ethnic data collection, and invited to participate in a national forum to talk about what we're doing. With respect to quality and efficiency improvements, one of the areas where we feel very, very proud has to do with our training. I have a fairly decent background in academia, particularly as a and as a consultant, and have provided healthcare training for culturally diverse populations over the last 20 years. So I think I had a head start on many people in the field, and we see ourselves as a great resource within DHS and the state of Oregon, and have worked with such diverse partners as Department of Ag, Department of Ed, OYA, Oregon Youth Authority, and a number of others. So we think we're making a difference with respect to that. And essentially, with respect to the question that was asked yesterday, we do not have departmental performance measures for my office, but we develop them for most of our activities that are included in our work plan. I didn't bring those with me today, but I'd be more than happy to share those with the committee. Again, it's an area where we've had, my office has a little expertise around performance measures, and we believe in doing those developmentally so that we do are able to show some progress, but over time revise them to kind of ramp up the bar so that we can go even further. We have no POPs to speak of. We are using fees to support our healthcare interpreter program. And with that.
Dr. Can you
Absolutely.
You're about to wrap up.
Yes,
you wait, you're just about to wrap up.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, I just want to say that. I want to thank you for this opportunity. I know this was brief, but I would welcome you all to either ask further questions of me or my office or actually visit if you ever get the chance. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Senator Gordon, then Representative Gerard and Representative Green.
Thank you very much and good afternoon, and thank you for your leadership statewide, but also thank you for the leadership that I know you provide on the national scene as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Mason, you said at the beginning of your comments that the focus of the office is on eliminating racial and ethnic health disparities. But as you pointed out, you have no key performance measures. And I'd like you to explain that in some more detail, why there are no key performance measures. And let me frame it in another way. This is a society. We live in a society. We live in a culture. And we are working within an institutional setting that counts and measures. And we invest in those things that we can measure. We invest in those things that we can count. And we count and measure those things that we feel are a priority, feel are significant. So help me understand why at a time when we have a national focus as well as an Oregon focus on eliminating racial and ethnic health disparities, that we would not have key performance measures so that we know that we're on track and that tell us what progress we're making or not. And I also asked the question, reflecting on the previous discussion we had about low birth weight babies and how we're seeing that issue concern in the African American population.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordy, that's a very good question, and I think I have to weigh in a little bit on that. One of the things with respect to performance measures, I mentioned the terms cultural and linguistic competence. One of the frontiers with that as a construct is measurement. I mentioned to you before that there are very few states that have performance measures around racial and ethnic health, although they do exist. We share those with our partners within the state. My office is, in essence, also has to be an advocate in advocating for those. And we have done so and we continue to do so. But as you said earlier, the issue of measurement around race and ethnicity is fairly a new concept. And I think we, as many people, do struggle with it. We've piloted some in my office that we would be willing to share with you and this committee if you would find that of interest. We share those with the department, and I think there is some interest there, but haven't had the traction that we would have liked to date. The other thing I would say is confounding is the, I mentioned data collection, but many systems do not collect racial and ethnic data in a standard way.
No.
Excuse
me.
Okay. And
we know.
Okay.
Dr. Allen, we know.
And what we are trying to do is push both public and private systems to do that in a more effective way. It is indeed a challenge, certainly for us in the public sector, but it's also a challenge in the private sector. So if you were to look at private health care providers, you'd find it, unfortunately, that most hospital systems even don't collect this data with a great deal of reliability. I'm not offering you up a defense or an excuse or anything like that. I will say that that is one of the challenges facing public health and health care generally. And again, a big part of what my office has to do is identify best practices and try to assert those in a way that gets heard. And I think we are making progress within the Public Health Division, but not as fast as anyone would like.
That's very good.
May I follow up?
We have 30 minutes.
Okay. I would like to see the piloted measures and have those shared with the committee.
Thank you.
That's good. Thank you, Madam Chair. You can relax, Dr. Mason. This isn't a question. It's just a quick comment.
Okay.
Thank you for recognizing the needs of rural Oregon. We don't think of the multicultural minorities in rural Oregon are some of the best-kept secrets in public health. So thank you for recognizing that here today.
Madam Chair, Representative Gerard, thank you.
Representative Boyle, I just had a question on what you mentioned, the PROMISE program, and I don't know what that is.
The PROMISE program, I don't know what the acronym stands for, and I apologize.
It's an acronym. Oh, okay.
But it has to do with underrepresented students finding internships and practicum opportunities for them. And it's a real good way and fairly inexpensive way for public agencies and state government to give their program a shot of diversity. It also, in many ways, jump-starts young people's career in government and in public health in particular. And we've been very, very lucky. In fact, as we're trying to recruit a former PROMISE intern to do my health care interpreting program.
Okay, thank you.
Very well.
So if some of these representatives up here want to put a little color in their office, they can call you.
Madam Chair, absolutely, I can.
Gotcha. Representative Senator Morissette.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, I noticed that you don't have performance measures of your own, but you do work with the state or with the department performance measures, and there's two of them, 17% and 28% of low income women who receive prenatal care. We already talked about not knowing that, tobacco use among young adults and so on, and pregnant women. Is your private study, or your, not your private study, is the one that you're going to give us information on, does that address these two areas? Are you able to collect data on those two areas?
Madam Chair, as Senator Moore said, no, I'm not able to collect data on those two areas. But I think what I can offer you might give you some insight as to the difficulties in collecting data of that sort.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mason.
Oh,
I forgot Dr. Mason. I did. Sorry, sir.
This is not hard. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Mason, I think I heard you say that you've done some preliminary work in collecting data already, and you were thinking of presenting that, either the Mets is doing it or the data itself, to a national organization. If that's the case, could you share that with us? Would you feel comfortable sharing? Is it information you feel pretty solid about?
Come while he's answering that question.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, absolutely. I can bring a PowerPoint that would be pretty, I think, detailing would be very helpful for you.
And talk, follow up?
You may.
And it speaks to minorities?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, could we possibly see that?
Yes. Alan, is that possible? Thank you. Will John, I'd like for you to make a donation. Thank you. Oh, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this.
Doctor, I think you've got to come back.
I'll make this very quick, this comment. On page 151, there are some outcome measures, and I very much appreciate your comments on the difficulties of developing appropriate performance measures, and especially comments from the senators on the panel also, and you would even use the word confounding, and I noted that. However, the outcome measures that I'm looking at, to me, look a little bit more like outputs than outcomes. And so I wonder if sometime you could maybe talk with the LFO analyst or someone else about how to... I know that you do need to collect some measures of outputs, but how we might also see a few outcomes. Thank you.
I have bad form today. My staff just came down, told me I have an obesity bill, and she said you should not be drinking Coke when you have an obesity bill. I stand corrected to all of our young people out there who saw me drinking Coke.
As long as you don't drink a lot every day.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist and the administrator for the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology within the Public Health Division at DHS. And I'm going to be talking with you today about my office. What I'd like to do is briefly describe to you...
Excuse me for a minute. We can join Dr. Cohn on page 121. Thank you.
Thank you. What I'm going to do is to briefly describe to you what my office does, and I want to give you a sense for the breadth of issues that we deal with, and then focus on the policy option packages, of which there are three that pertain to my office, because you all will be weighing in on those, and then, of course, answer any questions or concerns that you have as best I can. As you could guess from the title of my office, which has the word epidemiology in it, what my office does, and we do this in a variety of areas, is to collect data and information on the occurrence of diseases and injuries in Oregon and risk factors for those, and then to use that information, that's the most important part, to try to prevent those diseases and injuries. We are also responsible for the vital statistics system, which includes birth and death certificates and some survey activities that one of the POPs relates to as well. As you can see on page 121, our budget, this is in the governor's recommended budget, about half of our budget comes from federal funds, about 10% from the general fund, and then the other fund category includes the fees that are generated by the sale of vital records, and the tobacco tax dollars have already been referred to. So we're very, very acutely dependent upon federal grants. On the one hand, that's a good thing because we're bringing money into Oregon, and I suppose you could say that for investing 10% of our budget, you get 90% back from other sources, and that's good. On the other hand, there are some real constraints associated with that because those dollars have to be spent the way that the feds, for example, tell us they need to be spent, and that may not always make us able to address the things that we want to address. Okay, so the first section in my office I want to talk about is the acute and communicable disease section. This is probably the section that most people identify public health with. And rather than talk about this, I actually brought a few props. This is Wilbur. We won't quite stand here. Wilbur is a rabid animal, and we deal with rabies in our office. We still do have a problem with rabies in animals here in Oregon, fortunately not in humans. If somebody is concerned about whether or not they've been exposed to rabies, they will call the local health department, get some advice from them. Sometimes they call us if the locals are stumped, and we work very hard to try to prevent any humans from getting rabies because it is a fatal disease once somebody contracts it. So control is very, very important. Another thing from my pack of tricks, excuse me, this is a package of dull spinach. It's not real spinach inside, so don't worry. But you all probably remember the E. coli 0157 outbreak that occurred. And then more recently, this is great value crunchy peanut butter. And we had another national outbreak that was caused by our friend here, Sammy Salmonella, that had contaminated the peanut butter as well. So investigating these kinds of outbreaks is something that we do in very close partnership with our local health department colleagues. They're the folks who do most of the frontline investigatory work, and we support them in a variety of ways and try to help them do their job better. One of the things that we have been able to do in with some of our preparedness monies, I think, is improve the amount of outbreak investigation that we're doing. Last year, I believe we investigated 226 outbreaks in Oregon. That's a huge increase. You know, if you went 15 or 20 years ago, we were probably in the single digits. There are a lot of reasons for that increase, but one of the reasons for that increase is because we're looking and better able to investigate and address those problems. We have, by the way, had 60 outbreaks logged in January alone of this year already. Many of those are norovirus outbreaks. Okay, there are no POPs associated with our acute and communicable disease program, so I'm going to move on to the next program in your book. I'm on page 125. This is the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Program. And this has been an area of tremendous growth for public health, and it actually makes a great deal of sense. You know, 50 years ago, communicable diseases were the major causes of death and disability, but now chronic diseases have really moved to the fore. The leading causes of death in Oregon, heart disease and cancer, accounting for almost 50% of deaths, are chronic diseases. And there are other diseases as well associated with those, diabetes, asthma, and so forth, that our program addresses. Now, if you look upstream from the outcomes, though, as Representative Matheson was referring to outcomes, if you look upstream at some of those risk factors, one of the things that you find is that there are several risk factors that underlie a lot of these diseases, and those would be tobacco, lack of physical activity, and I'm sorry, Senator Carter, but nutrition as well is an issue.
So our
program not only addresses some of the disease-specific issues, but we also try to work on the risk factor side as well. And that's where our tobacco prevention activities come in. As you know, we have two POPs related to our tobacco prevention program, and I know I spoke to this committee before. I'm not going to go over everything that I said at that time. But the two POPs, one of them is to restore the Measure 44 funding that was voted in by ballot measure in 1996. 10% of the tax that was voted in at that time on cigarettes was to go for prevention. And then the other POP is similarly 10% of the newly proposed tax that's in the governor's recommendation. So that's what those two POPs are about. I think that we would really be able to deliver with these additional funds if we were funded at the level that's recommended in the governor's budget. We would expect to see 22,000 fewer smokers and probably billions and billions of dollars in medical costs saved over the course of the lifetime of these folks who otherwise would have gotten ill from tobacco. The key performance measures that are in your book refer to some of the data that I presented the last time that I spoke with you, and what I would emphasize is that the declines that we had seen have really started to plateau and in some cases even increase. You were talking a little while ago about the prenatal care and premature birth issue, and Dr. Bates noted the issue about smoking as a major cause of premature birth. We are seeing a slight increase in smoking in Oregon among pregnant women, and this is in the face of a national continued decline, so that increase is really very, very concerning for us. We know as well, I know there's been a lot of talk about health disparities. Tobacco is an area where there are huge health disparities. We know that African Americans, about 1.4 to 1.5 times the rate of smoking that's seen in the general population here in Oregon. Among American Indians, the rates are sky high, more than twice what we've seen. So our program does try to address this. We have we work with community groups in the affected communities to try to come up with strategies that will be effective and culturally appropriate. And of course, if we were funded at the increased level with the POPs, we will be doing even more activities in those areas.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cota.
Thank you very much. I want to go to the top of 129. Dr. Conner, talk about the juvenile diabetes database. Governor's budget proposes eliminating the general fund and putting into with the new proposed tobacco tax. You know, a lot of that's in flux. What's the amount for the database? This gets at the issue we're talking about in terms of tracking data. Diabetes among children is a growing problem. We don't have a sense of how that cuts across any kind of demographic because we don't really have the data. What's the cost of implementing the database, and where are we on that? And thank you.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek. The cost of that is, I believe, $100,000 for the biennium. And we have been working with partners to pull together procedures for collecting these data. It's not an easy thing to do. Even with $100,000, it's not an easy thing to do. But if the funding continues, we will have some data, I certainly hope, by the next time the legislature meets.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to continue on the topic of diabetes for a minute. In addition to data collection, I guess I want to preface my remark by saying that we hear a lot about the cost of tobacco use and smoking. We hear a whole lot and see a lot of firm numbers on those costs, the human costs and the budget costs and the health consequences to the healthcare system. We don't hear a lot, at least not in the last couple of months in this building, about the cost, what we're going to pay to deal with diabetes, the human costs, and also the budgetary costs 10 and 20 and 30 years out from what has been an alarming and rapid increase in the rate of that disease. Why are we not hearing about that, and why are we not seeing more attention toward prevention or mitigation?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, our activities in this area are twofold, and I think they're limited primarily by funding. First, let me say, though, that you're absolutely right. This is a huge problem and one that is only growing with the increasing prevalence of obesity. I know, for example, in children, when I was in medical school and when I trained as a pediatrician, we used to talk about adult onset diabetes. This was something that really only we saw in older adults who were obese. Now this is a childhood disease. Excuse me. And in some referral centers across the country, about 50% of the newly diagnosed kids with diabetes have type 2 diabetes. This is a huge change. And this is a very serious disease. It has renal failure, kidney failure down the road, blindness, neurological problems, a whole host of issues. So this is a very serious problem. Our program, we work in two ways around diabetes. The first thing that we do, we have pulled together, and this is with some funding from the Centers for Disease Control, we have pulled together a coalition of healthcare providers, health plans around the state, and agreed upon a set of measures that would kind of track diabetes care at the population level. So these aren't things that an individual doctor would use necessarily to say, well, I think you need this, but that at the big level, at the policy level, we could look at and see how we're doing. Are people getting eye exams? Are they controlling their sugars appropriately and so forth? So that work has continued and I think has been very useful for our partners and I think has raised the level of diabetes care for people around the state.
Senator Marsh, that and Senator Bates.
Thank you very much. Now, the other night on television, I saw a segment where diabetes is related to Alzheimer's. There's a direct correlation between all diabetes and a 35-year-old who was, they measured his brain loss, cell brain loss over a 5-year period. He has diabetes. A thin guy. But he has diabetes and there's a relationship to Alzheimer's. So that's a new overlay.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, the other thing I wanted to address is the prevention side of this, which relates to promoting physical activity and healthy nutrition. Again, we have no general funds invested in this. This is funded with some CDC money. We are very enthusiastic and anxious to do more in a variety of ways, and I know there's some legislation that you all are considering that I think is some very important steps forward around this.
Just a quick comment on, so we jumped into diabetes, and I want to come back to cigarettes for a minute. Just as a point of interest, the Juvenile Diabetes Database was brought forward by Senator Len Hannon, my predecessor, a great senator, because his granddaughter had developed diabetes. He was diabetic. He is a diabetic himself. And I am sad to see this cut out, and also thought it should be expanded to adults, so we have a better handle on what's going on in the state. So I'll stop there. But I would like to ask you a question about two things here as far as the key performance measures on tobacco. Number 20 is tobacco use, and there's something buried in the statistics here that's very concerning to me. The statistics can be misleading. I mean, Mark Twain said there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Okay. Having said that, at the top of page 127, 0405, this is youth. We see an increase of cigarette use from 8.1% to 9.8%. That is a huge increase in apparently 1 year. I don't know because you're collecting better data or something has already changed. And what's really concerning for me about this is that we know that when kids start smoking, they usually continue. Adults are pretty good about quitting. That's how we got people down. But most time when teenagers start smoking, or even sub-teens now, the likelihood to continue to smoke the rest of their lives is very, very high. And so this is the worst possible place I could see is kind of a change. If I saw adults, not as many adults quitting, I'd be concerned, but it'd probably not be as red flag that this is for me when I see more kids smoking. So I want to know, is it real? And if it's real, what's going on?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, I think it's real, although it's not quite as big as the 05 numbers would suggest. I actually just saw the 06 numbers. They weren't out in time for the press for this book, but they were at 8.7%, which is still an increase, although not quite as much as what we saw in 05. I think that the increases that we're seeing, are directly related to the funding for our prevention activities. Tobacco is very aggressively marketed. It's marketed to youth. The industry sees these folks as their future customers, and they are out there trying to get them hooked. And you're absolutely right that young people who start smoking have a much more difficult time quitting, so preventing them from smoking in the first place is really key.
Okay, you have 5 minutes.
Okay.
Doctor, and I apologize, but so much is going on. Dr. Bates.
Key, and the next one is key performance measure 21. Mm-hmm. We just got recent information out that I was only made aware of in the last month or so, that whether a person smokes a lot or smokes a little doesn't have a much different outcome as far as their health is concerned, as far as developing cancer, heart disease, kidney disease, and all things we associate with cigarette smoking. Knowing that now, which we did not know before, do you think this is a performance measure that we should keep? I mean, I have some questions whether it's really valid. It gives a false impression that if you decrease the number of packs of cigarettes sold in the state, therefore people are smoking less, even though the same number might be smoking, that you're actually getting somewhere. And information we have now indicates that might not be the case. And one of this is a performance measure we should really be keeping. We shouldn't just focus on the number of people smoking.
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, you know, there's new research coming out every day. I'm not ready to say that cutting down on smoking is not a good thing. I think it is relevant to, and it is a step forward. For one thing, it's often a prelude to quitting altogether. But also in terms of health effects, there probably are some real benefits for people as well. Because of time, I'm going to skip ahead to the other POP that I haven't talked about. If you go to page 139 for the Center for Health Statistics, this is the POP for our Oregon Healthy Teens survey. I just want to say this is really a core piece of infrastructure that you all depend upon to do your jobs, and that many of our partners out in the community do as well. Just for an example, this is a county data book for Marion County that we produce based on the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey. And these are data that are being used by the schools, by community-based organizations, by local government, by anybody in the community to address the issues that are facing their youth. These describe those issues with some hard numbers for them. So having a clear and dedicated budget line for that is very, very important for ensuring the integrity of this source of information for the future. With that, I will stop if there are other questions. Time will answer.
Senator Morissette?
One quick question or statement. Actually, I have a bill on hepatitis C. It's Senate Bill 769, and we will be asking that a pilot project be conducted on testing. Hepatitis C. So that's, I'm not going to ask you any questions about hepatitis C. We've already covered it, but I do have a bill. We'll be coming before the committee for funding for a pilot project.
Number again,
Senate Bill 769.
Chair Carter, Senator Morissette, hepatitis C is a serious problem. We estimate about 2% of Oregonians are infected with hepatitis C. But again, this is one for which we really don't have any dedicated funding for. And if your bill were to pass and be funded, we would be very interested in working in this area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And while Dr. Schultz is coming along with Dr. Allen, I do want to say, colleagues, I don't want to make an excuse for anybody, but we've got to do a better job of being able to fund our public health folk. And because they go more, they have to perform at the level that the federal government requires, since half of their budget is paid by the federal government. Now, it's true that we have a commitment at about 10% to 12% level, but that still is insufficient to do the kind of things that we want them to do. And I know all of us should be very concerned about the social issues, but the environmental issues as it relates to water safety and stuff of that nature. So maybe some of us can get together and start looking at how we can help better fund the public health department. Thank you, Dr. Skiles. And Dr. Allen, you can come up here.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, I'm Mike Skiles. I'm the administrator of the Office of Public Health Laboratories, and you should feel very grateful that I did not bring any props from my laboratory.
No, I got scared of the one that Dr. Cohen just took from here.
It would be a hard act to follow anyway, actually. I'm going to be asking for about $11 million a minute here, and so I'm going to go fast. I'd like to start by saying that we do three main things at the Public Health Laboratory. We do extensive and varied testing for communicable diseases of public health significance, including the ones to which Dr. Cohn just alluded. We also screen all the newborn babies in six states for a number of disorders, which, if they're discovered at birth, can be prevented through referral and treatment. And we also ensure the quality of testing in clinical and environmental labs in the state through regulatory activities as well. We have no policy option packages. We have no recommended reductions in the governor's budget. And we also have no performance measures measures for which we have direct responsibility, although as you can see on page 146, we do support a number of performance measures that you will find elsewhere. Just a couple of items on quality improvements and efficiencies over the last biennium. We've done a lot of modernization and automation of our methods. We've been able to improve the efficiency, the analytical output per staff person quite a bit, and we've also added a couple of new tests. We've added cystic fibrosis screening for newborns, and we've also added very recently a new way to screen people for tuberculosis that may be a replacement for skin testing in some selected situations. We also are deploying a new laboratory information system as well. And then if that isn't complicated enough, we're also moving our entire laboratory from downtown Portland to Hillsboro. Our current location, we've been in for about 30 years, and this move and the development of the facility has been in the planning stages for more than a year, and it's now about 65% or 70% completed. The actual revenues for paying off the debt and for the operating expenses are in the Department of Human Services Administrative Services Division budget rather than in our budget, so you won't see that here if you look for it, but this is obviously a very big issue for us. And with that, I'm going to just close and say I'd be very happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Representative Cortez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we've heard from, Mr. Scales, we've heard from other divisions around the need to raise fees, so we assume that the fees that you collect for the laboratory and licensing accreditation meets your inspection needs?
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, yes, at this time it does. And we were able to add cystic fibrosis screening to our newborn panel without raising fees, partly because of the efficiencies that we've been able to adopt, including automation. And however, we may be back.
Well, I would hope that you would just suggest that we don't get behind, like, unfortunately, we have another areas, and that's no fault to anyone else, but clearly yours have kept up with your need, which is great.
Thank you.
I just got to give this guy kudos. You got a program that is the envy of other states and other countries. You're now servicing our state and six others, I've lost track.
Total of six.
And the service you give to people and the diseases you find, which if not found, lead to permanent retardation or even death for kids, is just amazing. And the amount of money, let alone those lives saved and the quality of those lives, put that aside, the money we save in this is just amazing. These kids will grow up to be severely mentally retarded if they aren't identified at birth and easily treated with diet. And you just do an absolutely stellar job, and I can't say enough to support your program.
Thank you, Senator Baker.
Thank you, Doctor, for your work. Dr. Allen.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Dr. Susan Allen, State Public Health Director still since this week, I want to start by thanking you for your many questions and acknowledge that in the time frame we know we could not bring the depth to the answers that matter to us as much as they matter to you. Next week we will be providing you with a follow-up on many of the questions that you raised. We brought a few additional items of information today, including budget analysis, some pie charts that we think sort of slice and dice our budget a little more clearly so you can see exactly where the funding is going at the state and at the local level. And we hope these will be helpful. We also brought one page that we already had accumulated of various translation efforts that have been undergoing that we have organized within the Public Health Division. And I would like to remind you that was with no funding. We did this by getting staff together in a cooperative effort from across the full range of programs, and it's only a toe in the water, only a tiny bit of what we should be doing, and we will provide more information about some of our other outreach, multicultural, multilingual, and rural outreach efforts as well, which I fully agree is an important diversity issue in this state, or health disparities issue. The invitation to bring you our problems, I would like to point out that we have. And in particular, the budget that you are presented is not our current funding budget. Our current funding from the state is only 7% of our budget. 7% of our budget is general funds, which is in the lowest 5 of all states in the country. The proposed budget that you have before you raises that to 10%, which still will leave many of our programs running on shoestrings. We have some pockets of excellence. We have many programs, though, that I must tell you I cannot assure are protecting people. Public health is about protecting every single Oregonian. It's the only health program that is accountable to and responsible for every person in the state. And yet our investment in that is a very, very small drop in the bucket compared to what it could produce in health benefits and in long-term savings, as was just mentioned by Senator Baker's comments a minute ago. Many of these programs are prevention-oriented, and they're also about protecting people who have no other way to be protected from things such as bad drinking water or from excess radiation exposure or from communicable diseases when they're riding on the bus. So we hope that this will be the year that Oregon will decide that the people of Oregon deserve the true prevention and protection efforts that can only come from a strong state and local public health system, and that we have not yet delivered. It will take resources. We will use those resources appropriately, effectively, wisely, and accountably. So I look forward to giving a stronger report of success and outcome measures next year.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Portley.
Thank you. Is the governor's budget a prevention and protection budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the proposed budget that we have brought you moves us in that direction. There are many places it still falls short, but as we showed you the various policy option packages, all of the increases we brought fall under the area of protecting people, improving our ability to protect people, or of addressing health disparities. So we have a long way to go. This would improve our progress down the path.
There was one additional question I had for the Office of Multicultural Health that I was unable to ask at the time. But if that office had more general funds available, what would be the first priority for investment?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I do think that the data collection activities, which would not be limited to that, the value of the Office for Multicultural Health is that it provides a resource that cuts through all of our programs. My personal goal is that every program we have will be a health disparities program in some way, including rural outreach, including the language and linguistic competency issues. We do need to do a better job of assessing and tracking what the needs are and what interventions we can do that are making a difference or that are not, and we would quit doing those.
Thank you very much.
Doctor, thank you and your people for your presentation. And I regret that we didn't get a chance to get into performance measures to a greater degree than what we did. So I'll just have to report to the co-chairs. Time will not allow us to do that. And I regret, because I know many of you had questions that you wanted to ask along those lines. Representative Garrard.
Just a whimsical comment, Madam Chair, in that we had a discussion on statistics earlier. Statistics would indicate that if you put one foot in a bucket of cold ice at minus 400 degrees, put the other foot in an oven at plus 400 degrees, statistics will indicate you will feel nothing.
Madam Chair, if I may, we promise to bring equally informative data back to you.
We'll leave a little levity here today. Thank you very, very much, and thank you, committee members, for a very robust discussion.